if you are running payroll into the Philippines, well, you're well within your rights not just to ask what you're paying, but is that price on market? And where is that price obtained from?
Hello and welcome to the INSEAD Emerging Markets Podcast, where we interview business leaders and emerging market experts on business innovations, market opportunities, and macro-level trends in emerging and frontier market countries. Join us for the next hour to dive deep into the world of emerging markets as we speak with top performers who are successfully investing, working, and living in these markets themselves. Welcome to the INSEAD Emerging Markets Podcast. I'm your host, Nick Lal. Today, we are joined by Mike Robertson and Adrian Brown. They are the founders of Abicross. Abicross is a business-to-business foreign exchange trading and compliance platform for emerging market currencies. Abicross is available to banks and fintech payment companies alike and brings previously unseen price and data transparency to a fragmented emerging markets payment industry. So Mike and Adrian, thanks so much for joining us. You guys have a very interesting solution that I think has the potential to transform a ton of people's lives across emerging markets. But maybe before we get to Abicross, if both of you could tell me a bit more about yourselves and your backgrounds and how those backgrounds prepared you for creating Abicross, I think that would be a great place to start.
Yeah, look, thanks so much for the time and the invite. And I appreciate it's a bit of a mouthful describing what we do and really get that. It's fascinating. Adrian and I have known each other, what now, Adrian, 20 years? It's a while, right? We got together at my first banking job and his first banking job at the Royal Bank of Scotland, or RBS as it was known at the end of the day. And yeah, I've been working in this particular space, the fault line between payments and FX, ever since then, grappling with the problems that are holding back the emerging market space. And why that's important, I guess, is because, as you say, you know, it affects everybody in the world. 6 billion people, actually. It's a significant number, isn't it, Adrian?
Absolutely. A huge part of the world are affected by this inefficiency.
So what was the aha moment that made you decide that this is a solution that needs to be solved and you, the two, are the ones to solve it?
Well, Adrian, as a version of this that looks different to mine, I guess my aha moment was the appreciation, the dawning appreciation that nobody was fixing it because no one bank can fix it. It requires real collaboration. And the incumbents in this space have no incentive to fix it. So it isn't going to get fixed. And I think the aha moment for me wasn't so much aha moment, Adrian. I mean, I suspect a series of conversations we've had with that particular incumbent over the years had us realize that this ain't getting fixed anytime soon. I mean, that was my point. What was yours?
Yeah, I mean, perhaps I could, for me, it might be easiest if I briefly describe the situation I found myself in, to be honest, and that might perhaps flesh out the problem set that we're solving as well. So I found myself at RBS. Mike had left, I think, by this stage, and I found myself as a product manager for some transactional FX products. So sitting in the markets team, working on FX, but providing FX kind of pricing and risk management to the transaction bank. So the payments platforms, the trade finance platforms, you know, all of those kind of piping parts of the bank that need an FX rate. And most of the flow was via the payments platforms. And a large chunk of that flow, we handled it pretty effectively. And that was perhaps the G10 and the G20 currencies. And in fact, anywhere where the bank has a branch or the bank has a Nostra, which is a bank's bank account with another bank, basically, a slightly awkward way of putting it, but a correspondent banking relationship. So outside of that set of countries and currencies, which is probably 40-ish currencies at the average bank, you know, we have to get a price somewhere outside the bank's network. And we would typically do that by going to a specialist vendor who has banking relationships itself all around the world in emerging markets countries, usually not a bank themselves. And we integrate with them. We now have a price from them. Let's, for example, use the example of a dollar Nigeria. So we've got a dollar Naira price. So we can now price our clients. But two or three things really kept me up at night at that point. One was that I only had one provider of this service. We didn't just have our clients on the other end of the line, but we had other banks who were taking a white label version of our payments platform. So there was a real sort of fear for me that if this provider fell over or suffered some disruption for a week, I had no alternative. And I wasn't sure how I would explain to senior management that I didn't have a backup. And I went looking for a backup and I couldn't find one. This was probably 12 years ago. I suppose this problem was at its most acute for me. And I just simply couldn't find a backup provider. So that was the beginning of that process for me. The second part of the process, and Mike can perhaps flesh out what this really means for a bank, but the second part of the process for me was understanding the pricing this one specialist was giving me. I would check that price against the Bloomberg terminal, but find that the two prices never matched. And they were often out by a long, long way. And if I rang that vendor up and suggest they were trading off market, they would rightly say something like, well, be my guest, Adrian, hit that rate on Bloomberg, knowing that it wasn't tradable. And then we would talk a little bit about why the Bloomberg price was way off. For dollar Nigeria, that might be, for example, that the Bloomberg was showing the central bank's preferred rate. And our specialist provider and everybody in the market knows that there's a secondary market, the real market for dollar Naira, and that's what they were trading in. And they understandably said, look, you'll have to take our word for it. We're onshore in Nigeria buying Naira and selling it. We will tell you what the price is.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I'll let Mike take it from there, really, talk about what problems that created for me and for people like himself.
Yeah, I mean, simply put, think about this, right? You've got one price from one vendor who says, trust me. Yeah, come on. Banks and their customers rightly don't live in that space. We live in a space of competition and data that shows what you do. So to show your regulator and indeed your customer that the price you're using is fair, you need to compare it to a third-party data point. Banks can't do this and haven't been able to do it for 20 years in this space. It's unbelievable. It really matters. And so ultimately, the aha moment with these pieces that fall out of that particular problem, ultimately, your regulator should care about this. Certainly, your bank should. And if they're regulating the internal currencies, which they are, the ones that Adrian mentioned, the liquid currencies properly, then they should do it for these too. But they've outsourced it to a vendor. So the whole set and forget problem is what's really going on here. And so this lack of integration, this lack of a competitive environment is really the issue. It's quite obvious that if you have more competition, this will change.
Sure. Sounds like a classic startup problem to solve. Very inefficient legacy solution that's impacting a tremendous number of people's lives.
Well, we hope so.
No, it definitely is. It's interesting. So what's been your process so far? I mean, I imagine there's a ton of relationships to build. There's the product work to do to create your solution. What have been your challenges? What's been harder than you thought? What's taken more time? What surprised you in a good way?
Well, yeah, there's a lot there. I don't think it's any secret to anybody involved that have ever worked with a bank, especially a wholesale bank, that banks are challengers in the sense that they're highly regulated, they're slow, they have a lot of legacy technology, and so they're difficult to work with. So that's not something we were surprised by, but that certainly continues to be a challenge. Ultimately, though, we were able, because of our networks, to validate the problem, agree that this is actually a real problem to solve, and that the solution, which almost, when you've understood the problem properly, almost writes itself, if the solution is also workable. We sort of went around to our networks in, 15, 16 banks around the world, and lo and behold, we got agreement. So that was great. And then, of course, the rubber hits the road where you go out and you convince an investment community that you're doing something, and we did that pretty successfully. And then you begin working with banks. And although banks are slow, I think our pleasant surprise, and Adrian certainly agrees with me on this one, don't you, Adrian, that ultimately it isn't that difficult to work with a bank if you understand how to work with them. And we've got a good idea with that. So we've been very surprised by, A, the collaborative nature of those in banking who wish to solve this problem. They get it. And they see it as a solution that really could make a difference. So, yes, you're dealing with the mechanism of bureaucracy of working with a large bank. It takes months, not weeks, to do things. But ultimately, I think what surprised me most is that it is workable. We are getting, we are moving through that, aren't we, Adrian?
Yeah, and just to expand on the sort of pleasant surprise, what is really clear to us, actually, and not just the banks that we're working with, but the suppliers, the vendors of emerging markets payment services, is that there's a real sense that this needs to be solved not to the benefit of any individual bank or any individual vendor. There's a recognition amongst them all that this is a structural problem that has been holding the market back. And they are interested in working, sort of collaborating with each other, but kind of through us to fix the market. And that is to the benefit of clients. Often the banks, it's not just that they're passing on rates to their clients that are too expensive, but the banks themselves have no real ability to discount because they're paying too much themselves. They're sometimes passing this stuff on as loss leaders. They're sometimes passing it on with no margin. And so the chance to sort of improve this market, provide better pricing to their customers, which means better pricing to the beneficiaries in emerging markets countries, is something that seems to be of interest to all of them. They just want a better, more efficient, more effective market. And just a reminder, I suppose, of who the clients are here. If you think of the emerging markets, what you immediately arrive at is a situation where the bank's clients range from migrant workers sending remittance payments home, either directly with the bank or through an aggregator, an app or a fintech or whatever, who is itself using the bank, right up to the largest corporates in the world who are trading with those countries and or have operations in those countries and need to pay staff, So you've got individual workers in those countries receiving payments. So NGOs doing, you know, incredibly important work to the emerging markets countries, sending significant sums of money using these inefficient rails to help people who are in desperate need. So the potential impact downstream here is really significant. So it's been very pleasant to see how willing the community in the ecosystem has been to address the problem.
And the other thing I think that's also interesting here is that, Nick, I'm sure you've had many people on this podcast, you know, from the fintech space. The other really interesting surprise for us and why this kind of really resonates is that pretty much every single fintech that's a payment company anyway, I mean, not a payment company, you know, we're not that. Fintech payment companies have been funded on the narrative that banks underserve and overcharge. Now, I'm not suggesting that that's an argument that I agree with, but there's some merit to it. And ultimately, they build up these companies, but they end up on banking rails eventually. If you don't fix the rail, you're always going to have the space here, so this issue. So the other pleasant surprise was the fintechs we speak to have agreed with that too. And the investment community get it. It's a little rocket science. We're not necessarily, you know, inventing cold fusion here. We're taking technologies that exist. We're taking workflows that could be improved, and we're joining them together in an intelligent network. And there's a lot more to follow around a center like this. But that's really been the pleasant surprise, the basic agreement that this needs to happen.
Sure. Yeah. I think it makes sense as it benefits all sides, the banks, the consumers, yes, everyone. So that's really quite exciting. And yeah, even having fintechs join on, like I asked you when we first met, are you competing with Wise? And then you explained that they're actually, I'm not sure if we can talk about this on the podcast, but.
We did, yeah. No, Wise are in that space of pleasant surprise, frankly. You know, they also are impacted by this. But actually, it's probably worth stepping one ring outside of this challenge and just taking it a step deeper. The fundamental thing that banks struggle with is integrating a third-party vendor. It's incredibly difficult for them to bring a new supplier, so to speak. And as Adrian said, it's the work of months, if not years, to get it done sometimes. And what does that look like? It looks like if you look at a large bank that is bringing on a number of third-party settlement vendors, even beyond emerging markets, by the way, because think about it. If you're bringing on a vendor that enables faster payments, you're doing it by currency corridor. You can't innovate faster than the market, so you bring on vendors to do that. How do they access your bank? Well, they come through some sort of integration. There is no common integration into banks for this. There's no middleware layer that exists today in any bank that allows these third-party vendors to come on through a common shared practice. That makes no sense because in institutional and investing, where a bank has a single dealer platform, they already have that access layer because they have liquidity providers coming into them already. So this particular side of the market's been left behind on many, many levels. And so for someone like Wise, who are a really good proposition, this is an ideal way to improve their integration possibility to any bank. So it's really broader than just EM.
Yeah, awesome. And what's your business model? I see the benefit to the consumers and the market in general, but how does Abicross make money?
Yes, we are obviously here to make a profit, which our VCs will be thrilled to hear. But ultimately, we have a number of streams. I mean, Adrian, perhaps you want to cover off on the market data piece and the brokerage, and then we can extend the data into the industry.
Yeah, as we step the banks we're working with through this process, what we begin by doing is showing banks that have traditionally had just the one integration with the one vendor what the wider market for these services looks like. So we bring together a bunch of really strong providers that include sort of legacy specialists in this area, but also include quite powerful regional banks who are not seeing this float because it's going to a legacy sort of vendor, right down to fantastic fintechs like Wise. And so we begin by sort of defining what this market looks like to banks who've only ever had one provider and showing them just how rich the supply picture is. I mentioned earlier that 12 years ago, I couldn't find a backup provider. Well, the market was dramatically different. And we're not here to talk about Wise as fantastic as they are, but they are an example of people that were not playing in this space 12 years ago. So we start by showing what the market looks like to our banks. We take pricing from those supply side providers now. We have live pricing ticking on an Abicross Refinitiv page, and we are beginning now to license market data to some of these large payment banks, so that they can go from seeing on our platform what the market looks like to taking market data with that real market data. And what we provide them with is some analytical tools that enable them to start to bench their existing single provider. And those tools enable them to do a number of things, sort of historical queries, you know, month by month or in bigger chunks or an individual trade. and helped to sort of get a sense of what pricing was out there if they'd have had access to it at the time, and that then what pricing they will have access to going forward if they want to use the platform. They can look at this from a sort of percentage or margin left on the table, or a dollar value left on the table by on a trade by trade basis, or, you know, as I said, month by month basis. And this is the beginning of the journey for us of them of bringing some transparency to this previously opaque market. And
those stuff, right?
That's the now bringing some transparency. So, you know, we're talking about, just to step back briefly, not to get too distracted, but one of the unique things about international payments and why it's been left behind somewhat from an FX perspective is that it's to use the term that I learned at a French bank, that it's a truly transversal operation. So it's a cross-divisional, as you'd say, in an American bank operation. It's not just the FX team within the markets division, but it's the transaction banking team. It's the payments platform. Because of the nature of the complexity of this flow, it's a very difficult sort of market to make more efficient. And that's why it's been left behind. So the market data that we're showing now just hasn't been available to date. There's been market data showing pure FX trading data. You may or may not have had access to a limited amount of payment pricing, but sort of this industrial scale, best-in-class market data for international payments into these emerging market currencies is very, very new. And that is what we are showing at the moment, along with the analytical tools. Now, that is a process that we and the banks are stepping through towards a point where they can execute and hit those prices on our platform, or through other means, by the way, but can hit those prices. And once they are executing against those prices on our platform, then our business model, so the market data is a licensing model. We license the market data. But once they can execute on our platform, that is a fairly bulk standard brokerage model. So we take brokerage on the sort of per dollar traded basis.
And the cool thing about the brokerage is it's agreed, it's seen by both sides of the market. So your demand, if you like, the bank and the supply, the vendor, are both party to that. So that's absolutely transparent. The brokerage works because, in essence, it doesn't matter whether your supplier wishes to elevate their price. If the bank, the demand, deems its value, they can still hit it. It might be a service question. That's an important part of payments. It's not just the FX price. It's the service delivery of that payment to somebody's account on time. So clearly that's important. So yeah, brokerage that's in that space, that's clear, transparent, will ultimately drive down the costs within emerging markets. So we believe that our business model and our approach probably will see 30-40% improvement in pricing in some currency corridors, which is significant when you consider that. The third revenue stream, which emerges later on, is really a super rich set of data specific to this type of activity in emerging markets, which simply doesn't exist today anywhere that's in any meaningful manner. And ultimately, that's, you know, a well-trodden path, data sales into the data venues, the likes of Bloomberg and so on. So there are revenue streams here that work, and they work in the greater good sense as well. So I guess that's what we're about.
Yeah, I'm sure that would be super valuable. I mean, so many of these fintechs have been trying to get into remittances, and having more data on that would be worth a lot, I'm sure. One other question that came up when you talked about signing on the banks and the regulators was, what's been your process for engaging with the vendors so far? What's been their response, and how have you attracted them to the service?
Yeah, and look, if we look at the world through the lens of the top 100 payment banks, more than 80 of them use just one vendor. It won't surprise you to know that that particular vendor, which I won't name here necessarily, isn't thrilled by what we're doing. And I think that's understandable. I also think it's somewhat short-sighted, because ultimately what we're doing here is expanding and changing a market significantly, and they're still a participant in this market. They have an amazing offering. They don't exist because they have a bad offering. So there's a place for them to play. This simply makes the market more mature, and they can play in this space. But they aren't thrilled by it for obvious reasons. Every other vendor, without fail, has said, this is the right way to go. A common access layer that makes it easier to work with banks makes sense. A transparency that allows us to compete on the same footing as said incumbent makes sense. There's nothing here that should be worried about. This is a more collaborative. We're not displacing anybody. We're creating a collaboration of players that exist, and we're allowing innovation to thrive. You know, it's worth understanding, if you step back, Nick, and you go back 20-odd years, before the likes of a 360T or an FXall, if you were a treasurer at a corporate and you needed a price from your trusted bank, you couldn't just trust the price from the bank. You had to call the bank up, and you'd have one or two people in your office calling the other banks that you traded with, just to make sure, under price discovery terms, if the price was right. And that was like digging a hole in the same part of the ground every single day. It was thankless, right? Now you enter, and the MDPs arrive, and suddenly you have the banks that are doing the pricing and the corporates that want to use that service on the same platform. It transforms the world of FX. Now, spreads do compress, obviously. The business starts to change, But oh my goodness, the innovation that's driven through those centers has been astonishing. As Adrian referred to earlier, the institutional trading, it's Mars and Earth apart from each other now in terms of what things are. And that has never happened in emerging market payments, but it will now be happening.
Sure. Well, it's really exciting for sure. Is there any one emerging market country that you see the most potential or you're most excited about? Have you guys visited any of these countries?
Well, I grew up in South Africa, so that's naturally close to my heart, as is any African currency. But Adrian, we spoke about this, didn't we? You know, we often asked about this by VC people when we're raising money about exactly that. And what was our general response here?
Yeah, well, I mean, our response tends to be that we don't really think about the business in those terms. The problem, in a sense, that we're solving is for the people sending money. We very much hope and expect a benefit for the people receiving money. But we look at solving a problem for the banks and for the payment companies. And so all the emerging markets countries where the problem sets really is most acute are of interest to us. We don't sort of see one as more valuable than the other. Our plan and the thing that we have been doing is making sure that all of the emerging markets, sort of particularly, you know, all of the emerging market regions are adequately served by our platform so that there's multiple good prices on our platform for each region, therefore country. That is more our focus than any individual country. Of course, we are not stupid. So during pilot phases and things like that, we pick the 10 most prominent emerging market corridors by volume. And we work with our pilots on those. But there is no, of course, you know, if we're dealing with vendors who provide pricing for all of those countries, it's just as easy for them to provide all the pricing to us as it is for the 10. So, you know, the 10 is just for testing purposes. You know, we will move very quickly to a complete offering for that it'll probably look like certainly the 90 odd emerging markets currencies that banks typically don't do. But of course, banks of all different sizes can play on this platform, and some of them will be able to do 40 currencies themselves and need 95 from us. Some will only be able to do 5 themselves and need 130 from us. So we will have all the available currencies being priced to the platform.
Great. Makes sense. Well, yeah, I don't have much else to ask you, but maybe you could just tell us how listeners can get involved. Where can people go to find Abicross? How can they start using your product, whether they're someone sending money or if it's a corporate or whoever?
Well, look, that's a great question. And bear in mind, this is a wholesale play. So we're building an infrastructure that sits behind what banks do today, what payment companies do today. So individuals most likely aren't going to see this firsthand. However, they are certainly going to see the impact of it firsthand. And the way they can get involved is ask their banks, you know, how are you pricing my emerging market payment? Are you aware of an infrastructure that play that's ultimately going to change the fundamentals and the economics of this industry forever? This is the way it happened with an FX All or a 360T, as I said. So that's how they can get involved. I mean, it literally through the sort of lobbying effect of customer pressure. I don't want to be sort of cynical, having worked in many banks, but I know banks don't often move unless there's pressure to make the move. So customer pressure is one of those pressure points. What do you think, Adrian? I mean, that's the sort of thing we typically think about.
Yeah, and that goes right up to sort of corporate treasurer level too,
sure,
by the way. And certainly one of the interesting things about payments actually is worth noting that you might have a giant corporate that has a very sophisticated treasury that includes actual FX traders itself. And some of these guys have FX trading teams that are a match for the average FX trading team at a bank. And they are very much trading with and against their panel of banks in the wholesale market. But that same treasury team won't be looking at all at that same corporate's batch of salary payments to India or Indonesia or the Philippines each month. So there's a whole chunk of FX that falls off the back of payments that their own FX traders are not seeing. So even the largest corporates with the most sophisticated treasuries find themselves as customers of international payments and paying these sometimes excessive FX margins on the emerging markets payments. So as Mike said, but right up to corporate treasurers, there's an opportunity to talk to your bank. We're not suggesting, of course, that anyone start trolling their banks. We've been on the receiving end of these inquiries too, just to be clear, many times. But, you know, it is a healthy process for clients, particularly informed clients, to ask their bank to explain the pricing they've been given. And if you are running payroll into the Philippines, well, you're well within your rights not just to ask what you're paying, but is that price on market? And where is that price obtained from? And that's the sort of dialogue that we're engaged in with the banks and the payment companies every day now. And that's very healthy. And as we've said earlier, the pleasant surprise is that they want to solve this too. And so when it's kind of front of mind for them because everyone's talking to them about it, then so much the better.
But a hint for those listening to this, the way you query your bank, I'm just thinking back now as somebody who ran a payments business in a very large bank, the way you query your bank effectively is not to argue with the teller at the till, or indeed if you happen to have a salesperson on the phone with you, they aren't going to change too much. The way you query your bank properly on these sorts of things, you know, is my price fair, is you write to the CEO. Literally, that's what moves the needle. Senior people care a lot about reputation for good reason. And so putting pressure on a bank and getting the right answers for what should be the right questions, frankly, you know, is like that. It's not necessarily just quibbling or going to dinner with your friends and complaining about it, which is what happens a lot. Moving the needle actually takes some action.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the INSEAD Emerging Markets Podcast. To stay up to date on events we may be hosting, emerging market news, and to build your personal network, please feel free to join the INSEAD Alumni Emerging Markets Interest Group on LinkedIn.